watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. And welcome to listeners of 88.1 CKDU, Halifax. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Some of the items in the news this week. The Chiquita Fruit Company admitted its longtime funding of paramilitary death squads in Colombia. Congressional committees authorized subpoenas to compel testimony from Bush advisors regarding the suspicious firings of 8 federal prosecutors, while House Democrats arm-twisted their members to support a bill to fund more war, but which sets a date for U.S. troop withdrawal from Iraq, a bill Bush has promised to veto. And the reports from Iraq continue, with the toll of deaths by explosion or the discovery of yet more mutilated bodies found in Iraqi neighborhoods, victims of death squads. These events, presented as isolated news items, are in fact deeply connected. There is a thread that connects Chiquita death squads with their Iraqi counterparts, and that thread runs right through the fabric of the USA. As we will hear on the program this week, CIA and U.S. military operatives have created death squads, personally or by proxy, in countries as wide-ranging as Vietnam, El Salvador, and now Iraq. U.S. pundits have suggested that the violence is an indication of a culture not up to the task of democracy, in the case of Iraq. Let me suggest that the violence is a characteristic trait of any dominator society, one riddled with social, sexual, and economic hierarchies kept in place by violence, as they must be, because the people on the bottom of the hierarchy will not maintain that position voluntarily, and that includes in the United States. Here's an illustration of what I mean. From Florida to Alaska, dozens of homeless people are brutally attacked each year, usually by white men under 20, according to the National Coalition for the Homeless. Baseball bats are a favored weapon, as well as rocks, bricks, fists, feet, pellet guns, and knives. The coalition has documented 386 attacks on the homeless over the past 6 years, including 156 murders. The real numbers are probably much higher, they say, because homeless people often cannot or will not go to the police. And the coalition's analysis was not an exhaustive look at every jurisdiction in the country. In Fairbanks, Alaska, there was a series of attacks on homeless people by groups of teenagers wielding baseball bats. In Sacramento, California, at least 4 homeless people were hurt in BB gun shootings. Homeless people were bashed with clubs in a series of attacks in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And in Los Angeles, 2 19-year-old men who said they were inspired by videos depicting fights between homeless people were arrested on charges of hitting people with aluminum baseball bats while they slept. In a case that received national attention, youths were captured on videotape beating a homeless man to death in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. How would you expect such people to act when a government gives them a uniform, a weapon, and a license to kill? The press reports mentioned that the young murderers were influenced by videos and violent computer games. What wasn't mentioned, but what I wonder about, is how many of these kids grew up in homes where they were exposed to years of TV and radio broadcasts of the type typified by Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly that make a virtue of contempt for those less fortunate. The attacks on homeless people are, in my view, the extreme manifestation of the right-wing credo of personal blame that stems from the Calvinist doctrine of predestination, that poverty is a sign of God's displeasure, and therefore the poor are bad people. This ugly credo was recently demonstrated on the flooded streets of New Orleans. After all, if those people were any good, God would have given them SUVs to evacuate in. While sadism is not the exclusive preserve of any political party, the Republican Party of the Bush-Cheney era is a fertile ideological environment. Last week, I was listening to C-SPAN, which for our Canadian and New Zealand listeners is a channel that is devoted to airing the proceedings of U.S. government bodies and related authors, news, and issues. It has a program, Washington Journal, where listeners can call in to discuss the news items of the day reported by the host and his guests. The program deliberately attempts to give equal time to all parties and maintains three call-in lines, one each for the two major parties, Republican and Democratic, and a third for all others termed independents. Thus, it is possible to know, at least, who is a Republican and who is a Democrat when they are speaking. I was listening to a segment dealing with the emerging scandal surrounding the forced resignations of 8 federal prosecutors who appear to have been removed by the Bush Justice Department because they either prosecuted Republican officials for corruption or did not prosecute Democrats when asked to do so by Republican candidates whose campaigns would have benefited, or who were axed to make way for others displaying strong personal loyalty to Bush, a top requirement for the job, according to memos obtained by congressional investigators. These federal prosecutors are appointed by the president under law, who may remove and replace them, however, presumably not in a manner that constitutes protection of corruption or obstruction of justice. The many actions of the Bush-Cheney administration and their congressional allies over the past 6 years has highlighted once more how inadequate the checks and balances of the American system of government are in fulfilling their purported function, protecting the people from tyranny. A deeper problem is that there is a segment of the population inculcated to the love of tyranny, as long as they can do the tyrannizing. This is not news to black people, of course. I found most of the callers on the Republican line scary. They each brought up almost exactly the same points, in much the same language, no doubt fed to them by right-wing media pundits. These points stressed that the prosecutors, quote, serve at the pleasure of the president, as if the president's pleasure was all that matters. The callers opposed investigation into the firings, dismissing the issue as mere partisanship. One non-Republican caller retorted that while federal prosecutors might serve at the president's pleasure, the president served at the pleasure of the people, who had a right to know what the hell was going on. Another recurring attitude from the Republican callers was that anyone who wears a uniform, or who had done so, should be exempted from the punishment they so favor that others suffer. For example, one caller said that former Republican Congressman Randy Duke Cunningham, now serving an 8-year sentence for taking more than $2 million worth of bribes to dole out defense contracts, should not be doing time because he was a highly decorated military pilot during the Vietnam War. In other words, he was a guy who murdered many innocent Vietnamese for their effrontery in refusing the U.S. Empire the right to tell them how to run their country. The caller thought Cunningham should be made to pay back the money he took in bribes and then receive probation. One of the fired prosecutors, by the way, was responsible for putting Cunningham in the slammer. Meanwhile, these Republican callers, a couple of them in fact, were also upset that two Border Patrol agents were in jail for gunning down undocumented Mexican workers trying to cross that arbitrary and imaginary line called the border in order to find a better-paying job. Conclusion: these so-called law and order people are not really into law and order. They are into something else entirely: slavish devotion to men in uniforms, presidents, and symbols of power. This is the mindset that I believe produces death squads and torturers in any country. The right-wing view generally is based on the premise that human nature is violent and greedy, and strong rulers and their uniformed agents must be in place to keep order. I would like to suggest that this is upside down, and that these ideologies create societies that encourage brutality, beginning by conceptualizing women and children as the property of men, an outrage to human dignity that, once accepted, enables a range of violent and oppressive social relationships. I've mentioned before on the program a novel that many of us read in high school, Lord of the Flies by William Golding, a tale about a group of upper-class English schoolboys shipwrecked on a deserted island, who ultimately descend into barbarism and murder. This book is taught as an allegory of what happens when humans are removed from the structures of their civilized society, Britain in this case. But I would argue that this book illustrates that these boys come from a society in which brutality is inculcated, especially into members of the class that attends elite schools, the British equivalent of American frat boys, who are well known for their cruelty and violence. I must point out that various people lived on islands in this continent prior to 1492 in a peaceful and cooperative manner. They were called Arawaks and Taino, and they didn't kill the Spanish ancestors of the present-day Mexicans when they arrived in tall ships. This demonstrates that generosity and kindness is as much a part of human nature as sadistic domination. Had the Arawaks treated Columbus and his crew as the Bush supporters would like to treat Mexican immigrants, namely, murder them in cold blood, there would probably not now be piles of severed heads and mutilated bodies on the streets of Baghdad. Bitter irony, that is. There would certainly not be homeless people beat to death on the streets of America. In fact, there would not be homeless people in America at all. The point I'm trying to make is that the very philosophy underlying the society into which those fictional British schoolboys were educated, and into which the homeless attackers were also educated as the cultural offspring of the British Empire, cultivates this brutality for a reason, in order to channel it via the education process into the support of the established hierarchy of power and privilege, by promising pride by association with the most dominant, and the right to be violent and to dominate others in their name when wearing their uniform of service. Readings from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education will resume this week, and what I've already read, in my view, supports the assertion I've just made. The previous reading from the week before last told us of the decision to use schools to enforce ideological conformity to the project of empire and Americanism. I quote, "By the first year of World War I, American political leadership was ferreting out disloyalty and enforcing scientific conformity. Any number of private and secret societies appeared to forward this cause. The Anti-Yellow Dog League was one of these, composed of schoolboys above the age of 10, who searched out disloyalty each day from one of its 1,000 branches nationwide. Barking like German shepherds, when a disloyal yellow dog Otherwise, someone looking like you and me was flushed from cover and branded. Schools enthusiastically cooperated in dog hunts, as they were called. The U.S. Justice Department secretly empowered private associations as volunteer spy hunters. One, the American Protective League, earned semi-official status in the national surveillance game in time to grow to enormous size. Founded by a Chicago advertising man, the APL had 1,200 units functioning across America, all staffed by business and professional people. It was a genuine secret society replete with oaths and rituals. Membership gave every operative the authority to be a national policeman. The first location placed under surveillance in every neighborhood was the local public school. Assignments were given by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and by the War Department's Intelligence Division to report on, quote, seditious and disloyal conversation, close quote. That from John Taylor Gatto's book, which we'll hear more from in the second hour. In this case, there was a Democratic Party president. So though I've used the Bush Republicans as an example, this is a problem much more deeply rooted in this society than political party membership. Let's begin our examination of the context of death squads with a clip from freelance journalist Dar Jamail, who's covered the war in Iraq for several years. He spoke recently in his hometown of Anchorage, Alaska.
If you look at the mainstream media, you're led to believe that the U.S. can't pull out because if we do, as bad as it is today, the Sunni and the Shia just want nothing more than to just kill each other. And they're just going to run at each other's throats and kill each other off if the United States withdraws from Iraq. And, of course, we hear about death squads relentlessly, Mahdi Army death squads, the militia of Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. And that these are the main problem. As we speak right now, U.S. forces are going through the Sadr City area of Baghdad and supposedly doing operations to try to dampen the effects of the death squads. Well, I want to talk about why the death squads are there, who are they, and who's behind them. And we have to go back to November and roughly the time frame of November and December 2004 to talk about the death squads. Most of you probably know in November 2004, Operation Phantom Fury, the siege of the city of Fallujah took place, devastated approximately 75% of the city and killed 5,000 civilians and displaced 250,000 people, many of whom remain displaced to this day. And just two weeks into that operation, military commanders on the ground knew, could see clearly this has not succeeded. Most of the resistance had already left Fallujah before this even began, and all it's essentially done is effectively spread the resistance all over the country. It's decentralized this guerrilla movement that was already kicking our tails before this happened. So they needed to take another measure to try to get a leg up on the resistance. And so what they decided to do was replay an old scenario that they had used down in Central America in the 1980s. And so they decided they're going to form death squads from the two largest Shia militias, the Mahdi Army of Muqtada al-Sadr and the Badr Organization, which is the armed wing of SCIRI, Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, as well as another militia, the Kurdish Peshmerga Militia. And they figured they could get hand-picked people from these militias and give them some backing and some intel and some arms and send them out to target the leadership of a primarily Sunni resistance. And I was in Baghdad in November and December 2004, and we were already getting reports from all over Baghdad of hits that were already happening. This program was put into place at just about the same time as the siege of Fallujah. One, by mid-November, I was already hearing reports of Sunni resistance leaders being taken out, even Mahdi Army resistance leaders being taken out around parts of Baghdad. But who was behind it? Well, it was not a coincidence that the U.S. ambassador of Iraq at the time was none other than John Negroponte. underneath him, he had a man by the name of retired Colonel James Steele. And James Steele's title was Counselor for Iraqi Security Forces, and he answered directly to Ambassador John Negroponte. So retired Colonel James Steele was instrumental in facilitating the formation of these death squads, along with U.S. Special Forces and CIA that helped make this happen. And these death squads promptly went to work, and we fast forward to today, and they are by far and away the leading cause of death in Iraq. It's important to note that this was not the first time that John Negroponte and Colonel James Steele had worked together. John Negroponte was Reagan's ambassador to Honduras from 1981 to 1985, and Colonel James Steele, not retired at the time, his title down in Central America was commander of the U.S. Military Advisor Group in El Salvador from 1984 to 1986. Between them, they're responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of people in Honduras alone. Honduras even tried to file charges against Negroponte in The Hague, but conveniently, the United States is not a member of the International Criminal Court. Another thing about Colonel Steele, he also is famous for smuggling weapons to the Contras in Nicaragua and lied about it to the Senate Intelligence Committee, as documented in the final report of the Iran-Contra Special Prosecutor. So these two old Cold Warriors were brought out of retirement and inserted into Baghdad and quickly went to work, and the death squads quickly went to work upon their direction. And so to show how fast they spun out of control, by design or not, is arguable that they would get to the level where they are today, where they essentially control what's going on specifically in Baghdad and have by far and away become the greatest cause of death. The first Lancet report was published on October 29, 2004, which was basically 2 weeks before this program of death squads was implemented. And that Lancet report found 98,000 excess deaths in Iraq, 86% of them directly caused by occupation forces. This Lancet report, which was released this past October 11, so roughly 2 years after the first one, found that roughly 30% of the deaths are generated directly by occupation forces. So that's still a tremendous number. We're still talking about over 200,000 Iraqis, still the number doubled compared to the first Lancet report. But by far and away, the leading cause of death had become gunshot wounds. And it's very easy to see with the death squad operations that they are responsible for the majority of the deaths now in Iraq. So when people wake up in Baghdad, the people that I maintain contact there with there today, they say that their average day starts with them looking out the window and hoping that they don't find bodies on their streets. Because a lot of the same tactics that were used by the death squads in Central America in the 80s are being implemented in Baghdad. And again, for reasons outlined, it's obvious why. So there's piles of heads in streets from time to time. There's torturing. The most common way bodies are found are with their hands tied behind their back, with electrical drill holes in different parts of their bodies, and oftentimes tongues cut out, eyes gouged out. I have footage of this that will be coming out in a short movie soon. And this is the type of thing that is common now to find in the streets of Baghdad. This is why the neighborhoods of Baghdad are basically now divided along sectarian lines, where we have death squads, whether they be Shia or Sunni, because, of course, the Sunnis have now started their own death squads to do retaliatory attacks. And so Baghdad's neighborhoods, it basically depends on which sect of Islam you are as to which neighborhood it's going to be okay for you to live in. There's floating checkpoints, so various death squads will set up checkpoints at any time in places in Baghdad. And if you go through that checkpoint, it depends on what your sect is. If you're a Sunni and it's a Shia checkpoint, well, that's probably going to be the last checkpoint you're going to go through, and vice versa. There's over 30 kidnappings a day in Baghdad alone. We always hear about kidnappings of Western journalists, not so much anymore because the Western journalists that are there now, they rarely leave their guarded compounds unless they're going to embed with the U.S. military. So most of the people being kidnapped are Iraqis. The situation for women is, of course, despicable with this now quite fundamentalist government, U.S. puppet government in charge in Baghdad. Women's rights in Iraq, when it was mostly secular under Saddam Hussein, have been severely eroded. A couple of more, just some broad strokes about to give you an idea of how quickly the situation in Iraq has deteriorated. In Iraq in 2001, the average life expectancy at birth was 74 years old. In Iraq in 2006, the average life expectancy at birth was 59 years old. That's according to UNICEF.
That was Dar Jamail speaking earlier this month in Anchorage, Alaska. That audio courtesy of KWMD Radio, Alaska's weapon of mass discussion. Next, we'll expand the discussion to examine the broad swath of American foreign policy under both Democrats and Republicans, and how it has contributed to the types of warfare which we know as terrorism and death squads. We'll hear from William Bloom, an American author critical of U.S. foreign policy. Bloom is a former State Department employee. He left that organization in 1967 due to his opposition to the Vietnam War. From 1972 to 73, Bloom was stationed in Chile, where he reported on the Allende government's, quote, socialist experiment. In the mid-1970s, he worked in London with ex-CIA agent Philip Agee and his associates. Agee wrote a critique of CIA operations in his book, Inside the Company, a CIA Diary, which revealed CIA covert operations and operatives fomenting military coups in various countries. His revelations led, among other things, to the passage of the law criminalizing the disclosure of the identity of covert operatives that has recently been invoked in the context of the Valerie Plame incident. Agee is a fugitive and an exile as a result of his revelations, demonstrating that laws such as these apply only to people opposing the structure of power, not to presidents, vice presidents, and their aides outing covert agents in the name of presidential prerogative and profitable war-making. In his writing, Bloom devotes substantial attention to CIA interventions and assassinations. He describes himself as a socialist and has supported Ralph Nader's presidential campaigns. He currently circulates a monthly newsletter by email called The Anti-Empire Report. His many books include Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II, Rogue State, and Freeing the World to Death, Essays on the American Empire. He spoke recently in Los Angeles and is introduced by Frank Durrell and Don White.
I think it's time for us to introduce our main speaker for the night, William Bloom. His books on the CIA, Killing Hope, and Rogue State are the classic works of the history of this foreign policy of this country. William Bloom's works are in the class with Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn and Michael Parenti, and he has been a teacher, he's been a scriptwriter, he worked for the State Department, but his main legacy will be putting the truth out for us to read. It's a hard truth, but if we don't look at it, if we don't deal with it, it will continue.
In 1999, he was one of the recipients of Project Censors Awards for Exemplary Journalism. These awards are given to writers whose works are censored. And in 1998, one of his articles was one of the top censored stories of the year. It was about the United States giving Iraq material to develop chemical and biological warfare capacity. So he censored because he tells the truth, and the establishment does not like the truth. Shall we welcome Bill Bloom?
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. A few weeks ago, I spoke at a university in Flagstaff, Arizona, and that was the first time in a full year that I had spoken in the U.S., not by chance. I was sort of banned from campuses. It all began a year ago in January when, as you may remember, the latest audio tape from Osama bin Laden came out, in which he recommended that Americans read one of my books. Rogue State. And ever since that time, I couldn't get a speaking engagement on a campus. Five or six times, I received emails from students or faculty asking me whether I'd be interested in speaking on their campus. And I said, sure. And then they couldn't get permission from the school officials. So it was over, it was a full year before that ban came to an end. When bin Laden mentioned my book, I became an instant celebrity. I was on CNN with Wolf Blitzer and C-SPAN for 45 minutes and MSNBC and all the big shows. And even in Washington, D.C., where I live, I've lived there for over 10 years, I had sent in about two dozen letters to the Post, the Washington Post, pointing out errors in their coverage of U.S. foreign policy. Not one had been printed. I was totally shunned by the Post. When this thing broke with bin Laden, all of a sudden, my photo was on page one of the Post, and there was a long story about me inside the paper. And so you think that that would put an end to the Post shunning me. No, it's been a year since then, and they still don't use a single letter of mine or any article I write. But they couldn't resist joining the bandwagon when I was famous for 15 minutes. In these interviews, I had dozens of interviews on TV and radio and in the press. They kept asking me how I feel about being recommended by this evil man, bin Laden. And my answer was this. There were two elements involved, I said. On the one hand, I have nothing but loathing for any kind of religious fundamentalism and the kind of society spawned by such fundamentalism, like the Taliban in Afghanistan. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, I said I'm part of a worldwide movement whose ambitious goal is to slow down, if not stop, the American empire, to keep it from continuing its bombings and invasions and overthrows and occupations and torture and so on. And for this movement to have any kind of success, we have to reach the American public. This is what I said on TV. And to reach the American public, we have to have access to the mass media. And I said, for that reason, I'm very glad that this has happened, because it's given me a chance to be on the mass media, which otherwise I would never have had. So some of these people who were interviewing me may have thought, well, this guy is just using us, but who cares what they thought. The fact is that that's the reason that I was not upset by being recommended by bin Laden. Bin Laden, in his audio tape, he quoted a paragraph of mine from one of my books. He quoted just the few lines of it. The entire paragraph reads, "If I were the president, I could stop terrorist attacks against the U.S. in a few days, permanently. I would first apologize very sincerely and very publicly to all the widows and the orphans, the impoverished and the tortured, and the millions of other victims of American imperialism. And I would then announce that America's global interventions, including the awful bombings, have come to an end. And I would inform Israel that it was no longer the 51st state of the Union, but, oddly enough, a foreign country. I would then reduce the military budget by at least 90%. And use the money saved to pay the many victims of our bombings and torture and what have you. There would be much more than enough money for that. You know how much our defense budget comes to in 1 year? 1 year, it's equal to more than $30,000 per hour for every hour since Jesus Christ was born. That's 1 year. That's what I would have done on my first 3 days in the White House, I said. On the fourth day, I would have been assassinated. Another reason I think bin Laden liked my book is that it challenges one of the main propagandas of the White House, that the anti-American terrorists hate us because of our so-called freedom and democracy, our wealth, our secular government, our fashions, our culture, our radio, our TV, and films, and so on. But in fact, what the anti-American terrorists hate us for is our foreign policy. It's what we have done to the Middle East in the past 30 or 40 years. In one of my chapters, in one of my books, I have a long list of these actions which we've carried out since the 1950s. All the bombings and the invasions, the support of dictatorships, the shooting down of passenger airplanes, the bombing of their ships, and of course the unlimited support of Israel. If you look at the actual statements made by these terrorists to explain their behavior, it's very clear that their motivation comes not from these things mentioned by the White House. They come from U.S. foreign policy. In my book, I have many quotations from their writings and their talks. And the polls taken by very respected international polling organizations like Gallup in the Middle East, they show clearly again and again that the people there have nothing against American culture. They don't hate our films or our fashions or our television. That what they hate is what we do to them. Why not? Isn't that kind of obvious? It works the same all over the world. From the 1950s to the 1980s, the U.S. was intervening in Latin America at least as much as in the Middle East. All kinds of overthrows of governments, all kinds of support of dictatorships. And what was the result of these 30 years of interventions? Countless attacks, terrorist attacks, against American institutions, against American embassies, against American diplomats, against American corporations. They were reacting in the same way that terrorists in the Middle East reacted. No one likes to have these things done to them. It's very natural to want to retaliate. But that seems to be too difficult an explanation for the average American to comprehend. They think they hate us because of some kind of fanatic Islam. I don't think, by the way, that poverty plays much of a role in the creation of terrorists. The people who carried out 9/11, at least the ones who are alleged to have carried it out, they were not poor peasants. They were largely middle and upper class people. But bin Laden himself is or was a millionaire. So we shouldn't confuse terrorism with a revolution. They're not the same thing at all. For many years, going back to at least the war in Korea in the 1950s, it's been fairly common for accusations to be made that the U.S. bombs only people of color or Muslims, and we're accused of being racist. But the fact is that in 1999, the U.S. in the person of NATO bombed Yugoslavia for 78 consecutive days and nights. Yugoslavia, white Christian Europeans. So it's not racism. Any country can qualify to be a bombing target of Washington. It takes only two things to qualify. One, they have to pose some kind of obstacle to the ambitions of the empire. And two, they have to be very poorly defended against aerial attack. Those are the two qualifications. Pardon me. I'm also in the process of recovering from an attack of Bell's palsy, which affected the left side of my face. Affects my mouth and my eyesight, but it's almost all better. Another foreign policy myth I like to deal with is the motivations for the U.S. to intervene all over the world. I like to ask the question, what does Mae West have in common with U.S. foreign policy? The story is told about Mae West at the height of her fame in Hollywood, that she had this fantastic mansion, and one day she had a visitor who came in and looked around the mansion and said, "My goodness, what a lovely home you have." And Mae West says, "Goodness had nothing to do with it." And that's what I try to impart to my readers and my listeners about U.S. foreign policy. Goodness has nothing to do with it. It's one of the main barriers that people like me find in attempting to convince the average American about U.S. foreign policy. Because they were so deeply embedded in the American mind that no matter what the government does abroad, no matter how bad it may look, no matter what harm it may cause, the government does mean well. No matter how much, even if we clearly do more harm than good, in the minds of these Americans, our intentions are noble and pure. And so they are willing to excuse almost anything we do because they have this deeply ingrained belief that the intentions are good. And once, if you have that belief, someone like me can come along and present all kinds of facts showing that all the horrors that our foreign policy has done, and as long as these Americans are convinced that the intentions were good, you will not make much progress. And I get emails all the time from people who moan to me, you know, I showed this to my father or my brother, I showed your book to them, I pointed out all these facts, and they couldn't care less. You know, this happens again and again. It's because of this mental barrier about the U.S. meaning well. So the next time you meet one of these Americans, keep that in mind. Don't waste too much breath on dealing with just the facts. You have to attack this belief about meaning well. And often, these Americans are not even aware that they hold this embedded belief. If you point it out to them, you know, you say to them, do you really believe that our motives are always pure and noble? I have found even with people on the left, when I've raised this question, they say, no, you know, I really never thought of that before. It's a good point. And so with people who support the war, it can also be a good point to mention that or ask that question. And ask, what are all these people who support the war to make of the U.S. record since the Second World War? In that period of time, the U.S. has attempted to overthrow more than 60 foreign governments. It has dropped bombs on the people of around 30 nations around the world. It has attempted to assassinate about 60 foreign leaders, and it has attempted to suppress various nationalist movements all over the world, and besides torturing thousands of people. We have seriously intervened in almost every nation on the face of the earth in the past century, in the process of which we have caused the death of several million people and brought agony to many millions more. So I repeat the question, what are we to make of all this? If I were to write a book called The American Empire for Dummies, on page one I would say, don't ever look for the moral factor. There is no moral factor built into the DNA of U.S. foreign policy. You have to clear your mind of that baggage, because it stands in the way of seeing beyond the cliches and the platitudes they feed us all. It's not easy for the average American to take what I say at face value. They have a very hard time swallowing these things. They see their leaders in the press. They see them on TV. They see them smiling and laughing, telling jokes. They see them with their families. They hear them speak of democracy and freedom and peace and love and justice and human rights. They even speak of baseball. How can such people be moral monsters? They have names like George and Dick and Donald. There's not a single Abdul or Muhammad in the bunch. And they all speak English. Well, George almost does. People named Muhammad or Abdullah cut off arms or legs as punishment for theft. We know that that's horrible. We're too civilized to do a thing like that. But people named Donald and George and Dick go around the world dropping cluster bombs by the millions, and the many unexploded cluster bombs become landmines. And very soon, a child comes along and steps on one and loses an arm or a leg, or maybe two limbs, or even his eyesight. And our noble leaders use a weapon even worse than cluster bombs, depleted uranium, or DU. When this weapon hits a target like a tank or a building, it explodes into a vaporized radioactive mist of fine particles which are carried by the wind, and anyone who breathes them, these very fine particles, they are embedded in the lungs and in the blood vessels. They affect the genes. They infect the soil and the air and the water we drink. And DU has been associated with countless kinds of horrible injuries to the father and to his children. DU should be abolished. It's caused a worldwide crisis like AIDS. And it would be abolished if it wasn't for the influence of the U.S. It should be a war crime to use DUs. Some of our officials, as I mentioned, like to use or state benevolent motivations for their actions. But we should not let them get away with that. One seldom hears, even when a reporter is being fairly tough with when he interviews Bush or Cheney or what have you, they very, very seldom question their motivation. That is rare. And that is very important to do so, because it really strips away this cloak of nobility and morality that our leaders like to cloak themselves with. They're not used to hearing such an argument. The average American, if you raise this question about motivation, it throws them off. They're not used to hearing it. It's almost disorienting for them. I sometimes ask one of these supporters of the U.S. foreign policy what the U.S. would have to do to lose their support in their foreign policy. What for them would be too much? And I seldom get a clear answer, almost never get a clear answer. I think they sense that no matter what they might name as being too much, it's something that I know already the U.S. government has done. So they shy away from even answering it. You should also question about the U.S. claim to be supporting this thing called democracy. No matter how many times George W. mentions it in every speech, in the past 60 years, the U.S. has attempted to overthrow dozens of democratically elected governments, sometimes successfully and sometimes not. They have grossly interfered in elections all over the world, in dozens of them. At the same time, it would be difficult to name any right-wing dictatorship of the second half of the 20th century which was not supported by Washington. Not just supported, but put into power and kept in power against the wishes of their own people. In light of this, the question is, what do the Bolsheviks mean by this thing called democracy, which they talk about so much? I must say the last thing they have in mind is any kind of economic democracy, closing the gap between the obscenely rich and the obscenely poor. The first thing they have in mind is making sure the country welcomes corporate globalization and American military bases. That to Washington means this country is very much on the way to being a democracy. Another point to keep in mind when arguing about Iraq is that the biggest lie is not whether Saddam Hussein had those terrible weapons. The biggest lie is this: even if he had those weapons, what was the danger? Why would he have used them against the U.S.? What possible reason would he have had to invade the U.S. other than some insatiable desire for mass national suicide? And the same question applies now to Iran or North Korea. What reason in the world would they have to risk total annihilation by invading the U.S.? But this is a question you seldom hear raised in the media. They're concerned, do these nations have those weapons or do they not? That's all they care about. Oddly enough, most Americans who are opposed to the war in Iraq have no problem in supporting the U.S. intervention into Afghanistan. Why should they? It's getting revenge for 9/11, isn't it? No. What could be simpler? But what is this thing, getting revenge? If we are a rational people, we should get revenge against those who carried out the acts of 9/11. But who were those people? Of the tens of thousands of people we have killed in Afghanistan with our bombings and our guns, how many can anyone name were involved, had any kind of involvement whatsoever in the planning or the execution of the events of September 11th? The answer is probably none. We've killed tens of thousands of people to gain revenge on 9/11, and we haven't killed one person who was involved in it. Does that make any sense? Whatever one thinks of the appalling society that the Taliban created, the fact is that the Taliban were not terrorists as we know such people. They had not been associated with the terrorist acts. And the masses of Taliban supporters who have been held responsible for the acts, the act of their leader, what's his name, Omar, he is the one who invited bin Laden to Afghanistan. So all these people in Afghanistan are being punished for the act of one man. It's like each of us being punished because of all the terrorists in Miami. Miami is the haven for hundreds, if not thousands, of Cuban terrorists who over the years have carried out countless hundreds of terrorist acts of the worst kind, including bombing an airplane in flight. And if someone invaded us because of all these terrorists there, how would you feel? Would you feel that it was justified? So on what basis is there for having invaded Afghanistan? If Timothy McVeigh, you remember him, the man who was executed for the bombing in Oklahoma City, after he was caught, or before he was caught, would it have made sense for the U.S. government to have invaded Michigan or any of the other places where McVeigh had called home? That makes as much sense as bombing Afghanistan because of 9/11. Now NATO is playing a role in Afghanistan. They are taking part in the widespread killing fields. NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, what are they doing in Afghanistan? It's even questionable why NATO exists. Why does NATO still exist? They were created in the late 1940s, supposedly to defend Western Europe against a Soviet attack. In case anyone hasn't heard, the Soviet Union has not existed for 15 years. Why does NATO still exist? The Soviet Union disbanded the Warsaw Pact on the understanding that the West would disband NATO. Ha ha. And NATO still exists, and it expands. It increases its number of members every few months. It's up to about 30 countries now, and it's now in Afghanistan, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It continues to find a purpose for itself. NATO has no purpose for existence. There was an expression a few years ago concerning NATO, out of area or out of business, meaning NATO has to go out of its area or it's out of business, and that's what they've done. They've gone out of its area. And who knows, maybe we'll see them soon in Mexico or in Cuba. And it's all, the main reason NATO exists is that it's a wing of U.S. foreign policy. The U.S. can use without taking the blame firsthand. It can be seen as acts of NATO, not the U.S. Like the bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999, that was officially an action of NATO. Afghanistan and Iraq were bombed and invaded with seemingly no concern about the fact that these invasions and bombings would lead to the creation of thousands of new anti-American terrorists. The CIA warned the White House that this would be the result, as did many other people, and the White House went ahead anyhow. And since the first bombing of Afghanistan in October of 2001, there have been scores of terrorist attacks against American targets in Southeast Asia, in the Middle East, and even in the Pacific. All kinds of American targets, embassies and Christian churches and military bases all over. And so when you hear someone in the Pentagon say that our policy is working because there haven't been any attacks against us since 9/11, that's bullshit. There have been attacks all over the world again. In Indonesia, there were two major terrorist attacks against American servicemen in 2001 and 2, I think it was. Many American servicemen lost their lives. And yet, our leaders will tell us that we have not been attacked. That shows our policy has succeeded. Sometimes when I have a discussion with somebody who supports the war in Iraq, and the person has no other argument left, they'll say to me, well, tell me one thing. Are you glad that Saddam Hussein is out of power? And I say no. And the person says, no? And I say, tell me this. If you had a knee problem and you went into the hospital for surgery, and by mistake, the doctor amputated your entire leg, and then I came to you and I said to you, well, aren't you glad you no longer have a knee problem? Well, Iraq no longer has a Saddam problem. And many of them actually supported him, of course. Let me take you back a bit now. If you think what you have now is government lying and deceit, let me tell you how it was in my time during the Cold War. In my day, the big lie, the huge lie that they pounded into our heads from childhood on was that there was something out there called the International Communist Conspiracy, headquartered in Moscow and active in every country of the world, dedicated to overthrowing everything that was holy and decent. This is what they taught us in our school books, in our comics, on TV, on the radio, in church. The Red Menace, the International Communist Menace, more dangerous than bin Laden is taught to us today as being. It was international. You couldn't escape it. And almost every American believed the message without question. I myself was a good, loyal anti-communist until I was past the age of 30. And I even went to work for the State Department, hoping to join the great anti-communist crusade, until a thing called Vietnam came along and changed my mind and my life completely. But it was all a con game. There was never any such animal as the International Communist Conspiracy. What you had were people all over the world, in the Third World mainly, who were seeking to establish basic changes in their economic and political and social lives. Changes which didn't coincide with the needs of the American power elite. And so the U.S. moved to wipe out these movements and these governments. And they couldn't say they were fighting against social and political change, so they said they were fighting against communism. They're fighting the International Communist Conspiracy. And of course, fighting for freedom and democracy. And in almost all these scenarios, there was hardly ever any serious Soviet presence. But they would have you believe that in every case they intervened, it was to fight the Soviet intervention, and that if we didn't intervene, the Soviet would have a new beachhead in Latin America, for example. This word, a new Soviet beachhead, was a very common expression back then. And but remember, the Cold War ended in 1991, and the International Communist Conspiracy no longer existed. And what happened? Nothing changed in American foreign policy. Isn't that amazing? The U.S. continued to intervene and bomb and invade and overthrow just as much as before while the Soviet Union existed. That's not proof that this story they taught us was baloney. What else would you need to know? During the Cold War, the word communist was used as loosely as the word terrorist is used today, just as the word Al-Qaeda is used very loosely today. They would have you believe that any movement, any government, any individual who is acting against American foreign policy is a member of Al-Qaeda, as if there is a clear and precise definition of being a member of Al-Qaeda, as if people have a membership card they can put into their wallet, as if they have a monthly meeting, a monthly potluck on the first Thursday of the month, and they put out a newsletter every week. They really would have you believe there's a really organized thing called Al-Qaeda, which pops up in every country you can think of, in every form you can imagine. These are just more word games that they feed us, just to throw you off the scent. And the scent leads to the American empire. Keep this in mind. Following its bombing of Iraq in 1991, the U.S. wound up with military bases in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, Oman, and the United Arab Emirates. Following its bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999, the U.S. wound up with military bases in Kosovo, Albania, Bulgaria, Macedonia, Hungary, Bosnia, and Croatia.